The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about, in consultation with your healthcare provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from a variety of sources that I'll name as we go along. This first article is from MedPage Today, and it talks about Dan Marino and MASH. And no, he has not been binging the long-running MASH TV show starring Alan Alda, but he may have been binging on something else. Hall of Fame quarterback Dan Marino refuses to be sacked by liver disease. The former Miami Dolphins star revealed that he has been living with metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis, or MASH, for nearly two decades. Experts said his disclosure could raise awareness of a condition that often has no obvious symptoms and encourage conversations between physicians and their patients. Talk about MASH and educate about fatty liver disease in general, because the disease is silent, Naeem Alkhouri, MD, director of the Steatotic Liver Program at North Shore Gastroenterology in Westlake, Ohio, told MedPage Today. Usually it's asymptomatic, so knowing that you have the risk factors, you should ask your doctor about it. You shouldn't wait until you have symptoms. In an interview with People, Marino, 64, said he was diagnosed in 2007 with what was then known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, now termed MASH. The progressive condition develops when excess fat in the liver triggers chronic inflammation. It affects about 6% of U.S. adults, but more than 30% of those with obesity or diabetes. Left untreated, it can lead to cirrhosis, liver cancer, or liver transplant. Many patients are asymptomatic or present with nonspecific symptoms. MASH is staged based on liver fibrosis, ranging from F0, no fibrosis, to F4, which is cirrhosis. And many patients remain unaware of their status. Of those with F2, moderate, or F3, severe disease, roughly 90% don't know they have it, said Alkhouri, also chief medical officer at Summit Clinical Research in San Antonio. The minute you're told you have fatty liver, you should ask how bad it is and how advanced it is, because without knowing the stage of fibrosis, you can't really properly manage it, he added. Marino said that, aside from mild fatigue, he felt fine at the time of his diagnosis. The doctors right away said that can be reversible. It can be taken care of. But mainly for me, they were saying, like, you got to work out. You got to lose weight. He told the magazine, attributing his condition to mostly diet. Doctors emphasize that MASH can often be managed with lifestyle changes such as weight loss, adopting a Mediterranean or low-carbohydrate diet, regular physical activity, and avoiding alcohol. Controlling those risk factors is important, Alvin Hutt, MD, a transplant hepatology specialist at Northwell Transplant Institute in Mahanset, New York, told MedPage Today. Losing weight actually reverses this. The liver is a regenerative organ, which means you can improve all these risk factors. Then the liver will heal itself to some degree. Research has shown that losing 10% of total body weight can regress or even reverse liver fibrosis. The FDA in August approved semaglutide, Wegovy, a GLP-1 receptor agonist already used for chronic weight management, as MASH treatment, and Alkhouri said the drug could help improve on the low success rate with lifestyle changes alone. Unfortunately, the rate of success with lifestyle intervention and maintaining the weight loss is only around 10%, he noted. So that leaves the majority of patients not succeeding in achieving the goal of 10% weight loss. Marino retired in 2000 after 17 seasons with the Dolphins, leaving the NFL as its career leader in completions with 4,967, passing yards with 61,361 yards, and touchdown passes of 420. But in the years that followed, he said, "I kind of let my diet go." The pattern is common, Al-Khoury said, noting that retired athletes who don't adjust their eating or exercise habits after their playing careers end may be at a greater risk. They consume many calories when they're very physically active, and this is part of their training and bulking up, he said. Then, when their sports career is over and they're used to eating large meals, that can, on top of genetic background that predisposes some people more than others for fatty liver disease, lead to the development of the disease, and its progression may be at higher rates. Millions of Americans can relate to the Hall of Famer's story, Toot said. Losing weight, eating healthy, exercising, everything Marino did when he was playing for the Dolphins, I'm sure, kept things in check, he said. After retirement, he's not as active anymore. So I think that's probably one of the things that happened. And I think the way it's presented is very applicable to tens of millions of people across this country. Our next article is from BBC Science Focus. And it talks about how the just right amount of caffeine unlocks lifelong benefits for your body and mind. For many, caffeine is considered a guilty pleasure. But there is growing evidence that our daily fix isn't necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it might actually be doing us some good. The author, Andy Ridgway, goes on to write, "Caffeine has been getting a bad rap recently, whether it's highly caffeinated energy drinks making it difficult for kids to concentrate in class, or too many teas and coffees during the day, leaving us unable to sleep at night. Caffeine, in many people's eyes, is a cause for alarm. As such, the general advice regarding caffeine consumption increasingly seems to be to cut back on it or cut it out altogether. But it's not as if caffeine is entirely without merit. There's no denying it's a psychoactive substance. Or, to put it more bluntly, caffeine is a drug. The world's most widely consumed drug, in fact. Chances are you're under its influence right now. But like many drugs, in the right dose, it has benefits. It was the clarity and energy that doses of caffeine provided, distributed via tea and coffee houses of Europe, that helped usher in the Enlightenment and make the switch from farms to factories during the Industrial Revolution. But dosage is the key variable. And although coffee and tea have been providing us with a tasty pick-me-up for centuries, nowadays more of us are consuming caffeine in much higher concentrations due to the boom in energy drinks and tablets. This has prompted a rise in research into caffeine as scientists work to better understand its effects on us and the mechanisms by which it produces them. So, what are we learning from all this research? For one thing, just how differently each of us processes and reacts to caffeine. But perhaps more importantly, it's providing evidence that as well as perking us up in the morning, a few cups of coffee or tea each day might also help stave off illnesses such as diabetes and certain forms of cancer. So does caffeine really deserve its bad reputation? Well, it's the dose that makes the poison. Anyone who consumes caffeine every day knows the importance of dosage, how much to take in and when to take it. Get the dose right, and the caffeine can lift your mood and make you more alert. Overdo it, and you risk anxiety, tremors, and disturbed sleep. Both the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the European Food Safety Authority say that a daily caffeine intake of 400 milligrams, let me say that again, 400 milligrams, about 2 or 3 mugs of filter coffee, depending on the size of the mug, won't cause problems for healthy adults. As for when to take caffeine, or rather when to stop taking it in order to prevent it from affecting your sleep, that depends on how you administer it. Researchers in Australia and UK published a study in the journal Sleep Medicine Reviews earlier this year that tried to give clear guidance on when your last dose of caffeine should be. According to their report, you should drink your last tea or coffee 8 hours and 48 minutes before you go to bed. If, however, you use a pre-workout caffeine supplement, which typically has double the caffeine of a cup of coffee, that should be taken no later than 13 hours and 12 minutes before bedtime. The problem with giving definitive directions on how much caffeine is okay and when to stop consuming it, however, is that some of us are more sensitive to it than others. How long it hangs around inside our bodies varies too. Caffeine has a half-life, known as the time required for a substance to lose half of its initial effectiveness, of 3 to 7 hours in adults. The reason for this is genetic, but to understand it, you first need to know what caffeine does inside your body. So, let's look at caffeine and your genes. During the day, a molecule called adenosine builds up in your brain. Adenosine binds with receptors on nerve cells or neurons, slowing down their activity and making you feel drowsy. But caffeine is also able to bind with these receptors, and by doing so, it blocks adenosine's effect, making your neurons fire more and keeping you alert. Caffeine also activates the pituitary gland at the base of your brain. This releases hormones that tell the adrenal glands on your kidneys to produce adrenaline, causing your heart to beat faster and your blood pressure to rise. If, however, your daily caffeine intake is consistent, your brain will adapt to it. Your brain is like, okay, every morning I'm getting this caffeine that's binding to these receptors and blocking adenosine from binding to them. And so your brain creates extra receptors to give adenosine more of an opportunity to bind with them and have its usual effect, says Professor Jennifer Temple, whose lab at University at Buffalo in New York carries out research on the effects of caffeine. And more adenosine is also produced to counteract the caffeine. That's why it takes more and more caffeine to have the same effect. These adaptations take place rapidly, within as little as a week. Part of the differences in how we respond to caffeine is down to the extent to which each of our bodies have adapted to it. But there's also the effect of our genes. Caffeine is mainly broken down or metabolized by the CYP1A2 enzyme in the liver. And the gene that codes for that enzyme has been found to vary a lot between people. Research shows that, for the most part, it's the version of the CYP1A2 gene you have that determines how quickly you can metabolize caffeine and therefore how long it hangs around in your body. Fast metabolizers are able to clear caffeine quickly, so the effect of an espresso wears off faster for them. The adenosine receptors in the brain also vary a lot depending on a person's genetic makeup. There are also some variants of the ADORA2A gene, which encodes one type of adenosine receptor, that make people particularly sensitive to caffeine. It's also our genes that influence how much caffeinated coffee and tea we drink each day. Coffee is a naturally bitter substance, and so it's interesting how such a bitter beverage has become so popular, says Marilyn Cornelius, associate professor of preventive medicine at Northwestern University in Illinois, who researches the links between genes and caffeine. Based on evolution, we should naturally avoid bitter foods. It's a protective effect your body has to avoid poisonous things. It's therefore logical to assume that people who are less sensitive to bitter tastes will be the ones who drink more coffee. But that's not the case. A study led by Cornelius and published in Scientific Reports shows that the version of the CYP1A2 gene we have influences how much coffee we drink to a much greater extent than our sensitivity to bitter tastes. People with a version of the CYP1A2 that makes them fast metabolizers drink more coffee. And tests show fast caffeine metabolizers have lower caffeine levels in their blood. It suggests that they're metabolizing caffeine so quickly, they're consuming more caffeine to get the stimulant effects we equate with caffeine, says Cornelis. But whether you're a fast caffeine metabolizer or not, chances are you're pretty good at moderating your caffeine intake. The data suggests that whether they're conscious of doing it or not, people do a really good job of adjusting their caffeine intake to hit their sweet spot, says Temple. Because when they go over it, the effects are unpleasant, and there's a memory of that, so they go back to their sweet spot. That perfect balance of caffeine intake is potentially harder to gauge with caffeinated energy drinks, though. Studies show that the top-selling caffeinated energy drinks in the UK and the US contain 750 to 160 milligrams of caffeine. But research published in Drug and Alcohol Dependence reported that some contain as much as 500 milligrams of caffeine. By comparison, a 240 milliliter mug of filter coffee contains about 190 milligrams. That's 190 compared to 500. The varied caffeine levels in different energy drinks can make judging your caffeine intake tricky. But the complicating factors don't end there. Energy drinks contain other ingredients that interact with caffeine in a way that we're still trying to understand because we don't know what they are, explains Temple. All these blends are proprietary, so we don't know the exact formulation. But people respond differently. So we're studying the effects of energy drinks in the same way we've been studying coffee and caffeine systematically, she says. So what are the benefits of caffeine? While the formulations of caffeinated energy drinks and the effects they have on us has prompted a lot of research, there's also a growing interest in caffeine's beneficial effects. For example, caffeine is increasingly being used as a legal performance-enhancing drug in competitive sports. A review of research into caffeine and athletic performance by the International Society of Sports Nutrition in 2022 said caffeine has a small to moderate effect on muscle endurance and strength. Its biggest effects on performance are seen in endurance sports, though. It's thought that at least some of this performance boost is likely down to caffeine aiding muscle contraction by changing levels of calcium, sodium, and potassium, as well as acting as a painkiller. There has also been a raft of studies attempting to determine how caffeine boosts our cognitive abilities. They've found that a moderate dose, up to 300 milligrams, helps us stay focused for longer. Some research also shows that in the long term, caffeine can boost our memory, but here the evidence is somewhat mixed. When it comes to determining the long-term health benefits of caffeine, things get complicated as most of the research has been carried out with coffee, which contains a cocktail of bioactive ingredients. Deciphering whether it's caffeine or one of the many other components of coffee that brings about a health benefit is difficult. There's good news for coffee drinkers, though. A review published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2020 reports that your regular coffee fix reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, liver disease, and certain forms of cancer, such as liver cancer. For some conditions, such as type 2 diabetes, research shows it's not the caffeine, but some other component of coffee that helps to prevent them, as decaf coffee reduces the risk just like caffeinated coffee. But interestingly, if you look at other conditions such as Parkinson's disease, it seems to be completely the caffeine, says Rob Van Dam, professor of exercise nutrition sciences and epidemiology at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., who led the review. Then there are some that sit in the middle, like liver cancer. It seems that caffeine may have some benefit, but there may be additional gain from other components of coffee. In the future, scientists will discover more about our genes and how they determine the effects of caffeine and coffee on us. And the more we learn, the closer we'll get to the prospect of personalized guidance for daily caffeine intake. Most of the guidelines for caffeine have already been just looking at the population level, says Cornelius. They don't account for the individual variation, and we're at a stage in research where there are opportunities for personalized nutrition. Well, caffeine is a lot more complex than I knew before I read that article. I hope it was helpful for you. Our next article may help encourage you to think about going to your dentist more often. It's from The Scientist, and it's entitled Biofilm Bacteria May Fuel Heart Attacks. The writer, Sahana Sitaraman, who's a PhD, writes, "While the world was busy solving Rubik's cubes and marveling over Doc Brown's DeLorean time machine in the 1980s, scientists began noticing a peculiar relationship between dental health and heart disease. Individuals who suffered myocardial infarctions, commonly known as heart attacks, or had chronic coronary heart disease, had higher levels of antibodies against infectious bacteria and had more dental infections compared to healthy counterparts. This gave way to the idea that bacterial infections might cause chronic inflammation of arterial blocks, a key risk factor for cardiac events. Everybody thought that we can solve this myocardial infarction problem by giving patients antibiotics," said Pekka Karonen, a physician scientist at Tampere University in Finland who studies the link between oral bacteria and cardiovascular health. However, most clinical trials failed to reduce the cardiac risk, so the infection hypothesis was forgotten for 20 years, Karonen said. Now, after almost four decades, Karonen and his colleagues reported that hardened cholesterol plaques in arteries may harbor oral bacteria encased in a biofilm, thus making them impervious to antibiotics and the body's immune system. It's not the bacteria themselves, but the response by the host that starts to destroy the structures that lead to myocardial infarction, Karonen said. These findings, published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, open avenues for the development of new biofilm-targeted ways to diagnose and prevent heart attacks. This is quite intriguing, said Stanley Hazen, a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic who was not involved in the study. It's another piece of evidence that argues for a potential infectious cause to cardiovascular disease risk. What inspired Karonen to shake the dust off the infection hypothesis after decades? In 2005, a colleague working on bacterial DNA detection approached Karonen, who worked as a forensic pathologist at the time, for samples of coronary artery plaques or atheromas. Using bacterial DNA amplification methods, the researchers found that the atheromas contained genetic material from viridans streptococci, a prevalent group of commensal bacteria found in the oral microbiome, among various other species. "We were quite surprised," Karonen said. "We thought that we had made some mistake in the autopsy room. To understand the effects of bacteria on the atheromas more deeply, Karonen and his colleagues studied arterial plaques obtained from 121 sudden death victims and 96 surgical patients. Quantitative PCR experiments revealed that 65% of the sudden death plaque samples and 58% of the surgical plaques had DNA from oral viridin streptococci, mainly Streptococcus mitis. To determine the presence of actual bacteria, not just their DNA, the researchers stained samples using antibodies against three of the most common Burundian streptococci and observed that more than half of the sudden death and surgical samples showed presence of bacteria within the core of the plaques. When they co-stained the plaques with a macrophage biomarker, they observed that the immune cells did not detect the bacterial clumps inside the atheromas, indicating that the bacteria were encased in a biofilm. "I almost fell off my chair," Karnan said. Next, the researchers analyzed ruptured plaques, which cause myocardial infarctions, and observed staining for streptococci that appeared to have originated from the biofilm infiltrating the rupture site and that were then engulfed by macrophages. Using genome-wide expression analysis of the surgically removed arterial plaques, Karnan and his colleagues also observed an under-regulation of immune pathways for recognizing and killing bacteria compared to healthy arteries. You would not expect to see the type of immune responses that were observed at the sites of plaque rupture if it happened post-mortem, Hazen said. But how exactly did the bacteria enter and thrive inside these oxygen-deficient atheromas? The team observed the presence of new blood vessels feeding the core of the plaques, forming a direct highway for bacteria to enter and set up camp inside these structures. Karnan and his team now want to understand why biofilm bacteria start dividing again. They speculate that an external trigger, such as a viral infection or limited nutrition, might lead to proliferation of the bacteria and subsequent immune response. Using viral metagenomics, they're analyzing all possible viruses present in the plaque samples to ascertain if there might be a possible link between viral infections and plaque rupture. The researchers are also starting new antibiotic trials to treat myocardial infarctions. If we start antibiotics treatment immediately, it might affect the outcome of these patients, Karnan said. Hazen emphasized the huge burden of heart disease worldwide and the underappreciated role of oral hygiene in cardiac risk. Anything that casts more light on that and the whole concept of preventive cardiology is an important message, he said. Well, we're out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.